nurse midwives at home, parents and teen smoking, building insulin-producing cells in the lab, and we're going to take a look at general medication administration concepts. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week as we roll on up on, here it is, September 11th, 2009. You know, as a firefighter and paramedic before I became a nurse, I can't believe it's been 8 years since that disaster and tragedy occurred. Anyway, we move forward, and I just want to let all of you know that I hope you are thinking of that time frame and the individuals, rescuers, and otherwise who lost their lives that day in a variety of locations around this country. In the meantime, I want to remind you that you can follow up on the information here, plus check out a whole bunch of other articles and information over at nursingshow.com. There you'll find links to this program, as well as links and show notes and follow-up information for you for all of the tips, news items, and everything else you'll find in each and every episode of The Nursing Show. And again, that's over at nursingshow.com. Now, you're checking out that stuff. What if you want to get back in touch with me? What if you have something to say that's really getting to you? Well, you can leave a comment right there on any of the articles. There's links either at the top or the bottom of the article there. Just go ahead and click on that link and leave your comment right there. Or you can send me an email, comments@nursingshow.com, and I will get back to you. I respond to every email I get. I really try to keep in touch with all of the listeners as best I can, so I will get back to you if you send me an email. You can also catch up with me over at Facebook. I'm under the title Pod Medic there, and also on Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic. So please get in touch with me, friend me up, or follow the Nursing Show page over at Facebook and really get involved with the Nursing Show. This is your community progress effort here, and everything that happens on this show is as a result of comments and thoughts and ideas that come from you, and I try to relay back to you the things you want to hear from the Nursing Show. Let's look on into this week's news. And, you know, the debate over the safety of nurse midwives and home births is something that I see cropping up in the radar on the Nursing Show here every 3 to 6 months. It seems that this debate is just not going to go away. However, I always like when I see not just articles on the debate, but actually studies that are looking at the safety of having a birth at home, a planned birth with a attendance of a midwife or a nurse midwife. And this has been something that has been hotly debated in a lot of different countries, from the United States, Canada, Australia, and many others. And so it's always interesting to see what's going on out there and the safety and efficacy of having a planned home birth as opposed to having a birth in a hospital. This particular article I found over at medicalnewstoday.com from the Canadian Medical Association Journal. And the study looked at 2,800 home births as compared to 4,700 hospital births attended by nurse midwives, and compared those hospital and home births with similar births, about 5,000 physician-attended births in a hospital. It found that there was no significant difference between a nurse midwife attending a home planned birth or a hospital birth, and it also found that women who planned a home birth had a significantly lower risk of obstetric interventions, adverse outcomes. And this included things that are like augmentation of labor, electronic fetal monitoring, epidural analgesia, assisted vaginal delivery, C-section, hemorrhage, and infection. The safety of home births in this article is pointed out is under debate among many of the more advanced nations of the world. Obviously, the developing nations have to make do with having births occur with whatever resources they have at hand. And in those places, having available facilities is a luxury. So nurse midwives and midwives and traditional medicine are the watchwords there. But in the developed world, this is a hot debate in places like New Zealand, Australia, America, and Canada. And so this is a pretty big review of these things. And I think it's an important review. I think we need to get away from always having to go to a facility for some of the medical care that we need. And certainly a birth with a well-monitored mother and fetus with all of the safety planned ahead of time, if there are no significant complications in the pregnancy, there certainly should be no reason why a home birth cannot be at least planned for. There may be complications at a late time approaching the birth, and certainly the availability of contacting an ambulance or getting to the hospital if there are apparent complications appearing are certainly available to most people. And I think that that's the case. Also, you avoid all of the issues with hospital-based infection, with all of the side effects associated with being in a facility, including lack of rest and just too much, too much care focused on reviewing and protecting the hospital's posterior, and rather than protecting the patient themselves. I think a lot of times, you know, people would just like to sleep, and if they're otherwise healthy, why do we need to interrupt and check on them quite as frequently as we do? So these are things that we need to be aware of, and I think that these kinds of studies just point to the reason why we should be moving back towards a home-based care model for simple and more frequent and regular medical treatment. And I include birth in regular medical treatment. And this is a natural occurrence. People had babies without hospitals for millions of years. We don't need to worry about, I don't think we need to be focusing quite on getting into the facilities as much as we do in this case. So moving from parents and newborn babies up to parents and teenagers, two ends of the parenting spectrum, there was a recent study that was published in the journal Pediatrics in the September online issue, and this was looking at parents and their role in affecting teen tobacco use and the teen tobacco use as it became a daily habit. Now, we know that parents can have an impact on their children, and so often this is just not noticed by the parents because they don't bother or are afraid to approach their children. They think if they just ignore it, it'll go away. But if you have a teen who's smoking, what real effects can a parent have on that child? Well, clearly, if parents smoke, it's more likely that their teens will smoke. They have more access to cigarettes, and their parents may be less actively involved in keeping their teens from smoking if they smoke themselves. But there are other things that parents can do. You know, parents can communicate clearly with their children, and this article seems to point in the direction that communication had a significant effect. When parents know that their teens smoke, if they can clearly communicate, set boundaries, and communicate that that is not a desired activity, this can be much less likely to develop into a daily habit. This particular study looked at 270 adolescents who had begun smoking by the eighth grade, but not to a daily pattern at that time. And they reviewed those students through 12th grade and found that about 58% of them had become daily smokers. These students had other factors that caused them to be at greater risk for developing a daily smoking habit. And this included not just parental factors, but other factors, as would be expected in teenagers, such as having friends who smoked and other problem behaviors that might link to teen issues with rebellion, skipping school, getting into fights, engaging in vandalism, all were predictors of teens who were likely to develop daily habits with tobacco use. Just looking at these kinds of studies, it just points out how very important it is to talk with our patients about not just their health, if you have adult patients, but about their family's health and approach with them, if they are a smoker, how they can keep their kids from growing up to be smokers too. Sometimes those kinds kinds of factors can be a good kick for parents to stop smoking. And having a frank and honest discussion with their kids about smoking and how they're hooked and that how they deal with the issues of smoking all the time can be a good way for developing open communication about a lot of issues about which parents should be talking with their kids. Finally, I will just touch on a new technology development. I try to keep an eye on things like this. Type 2 and type 1 diabetes are significant epidemic proportions in many developed nations. The United States especially has a huge issue with an epidemic of diabetes. And wouldn't it be great if we could find a way for type 1 diabetics to replace or grow cells that could produce insulin since their pancreas can't do that? And one of the ways that this can be done is by trying to grow new insulin-producing cells. Seems like science fiction, but apparently this is something scientists are actually engaging with. This is an organization from the New York area, New York Stem Cell Foundation, provided some funding for this particular study that I found over at medicinenet.com. And it looks at using skin cells from people with type 1 diabetes and giving that access to researchers who were able to reproduce these cells and cause them to make insulin. Now, this was at lower levels than normal pancreatic cells would, but it certainly is an indication that this is something that could be possible. And of course, the ultimate goal would be to be able to grow a mass of insulin-producing cells that we could then put back into the patient's body. And if it's produced from their own cellular material, of course, rejection wouldn't be as much of an issue, if at all. So it's something to keep track of, and I just wanted to point out that this is just a technology that's on the horizon and another option, hopefully, within not too many years of treating and curing type 1 diabetics in this country and around the world. So I'm excited about this. As this continues to progress, hopefully it will enable our patients with type 1 diabetes to live much more normal lives. Time for this week's tip of the week, and for today's episode, we're going to be talking about some key ideas to keep in mind during medication administration. You know, safe medication administration is such a hot topic in most facilities, and it's something that many nurses probably think about as a matter of routine. But with so many nursing students that listen to this show, and for people that need just a refresher, and I think we all should try to review these key concepts and bring them back to the forefront of our minds, it's time for us to just kind of look at some basic concepts surrounding medication administration. Wanted to point out that this is going to be a shortened version of a longer video tip that I've included over at the nursingtopstudent.com site. So if you want a longer, about 20-minute, 22-minute version of this with some additional PowerPoint type slide information and some other downloads associated with it, you should, if you're a member over there, check that out. Now, it's understood as nurses that we are going to be really understanding the medications we give to our patients and also understanding the medications that we might be educating patients about prior to discharge or over the phone during a call into a physician's office. We certainly need to make sure we know about the medication before we can administer it safely or educate about it safely. This includes knowing what's supposed to happen to the patient. This is the expected action of the medication, what it's doing for that patient, what can happen or side effects and other things that might happen as a result of administering this medication. We need to know why the med's being given to this patient. It may be for a variety of different reasons, but we certainly need to be keeping that in the front of our minds. We need to understand interactions, how this medication will interact with everything in the patient's life, including their other medications, their diet, their lifestyle, their environment. All of these things may come into play when we're talking about interactions with medications. And then we need to understand the different ways medications get into patients' bodies, because certain medications come in different forms, and we need to understand the best route of administration for a given patient at a given time. And that may change just in the course of a few hours. If a patient's taking a PO med, they could rapidly lose mental status and not be able to protect their airway, and that medication might still need to be administered, but it might have to go in an injectable form or some other route. And also, does the patient understand the medication and are they able to use it safely on their own? And that requires us to educate our patients. So what's supposed to happen with our medications? Let's start with that. We need to understand some things like the general medication class. If we know what class of drugs this is, whether it's an antibiotic or an antiarrhythmic or a vaccine or whatever it might be, we can understand more about what this medication does and what to expect to happen, because general classes of medications give us an idea of what we should be seeing. We should also think about the routes of administration, because what's supposed to happen may happen at different time frames depending on how it's administered, and also routes of administration can affect the end action as well because of the dose, loading dose of medication that ends up in the bloodstream faster or slower. We also need to, of course, remember pharmacokinetics, because what's supposed to happen has a lot to do with how that medication is transported through the body, absorbed, distributed, metabolized, and later eliminated. All of that is important to keep in the back of our minds. Now, what can happen? Well, this can often be thought of as side effects, but I think it relates to a lot more than that. Contraindications. Why don't we want to give this medication to someone in certain situations with certain medical histories or certain other medications on board? Obviously, those can give us a good idea of some negative side effects that might occur if we understand the contraindications. And then the side effects themselves, and not just the side effects of the medication, but also including the side effects of the different ways we administer that medication, and also the side effects of expected interactions. We may be giving a medication knowing that there's a possible interaction, and that is going to have side effects that we may need to weigh versus what's going on with the patient. And physicians do this all the time, but we need to understand that there may be some expected side effects based upon other meds, and we need to keep an eye on those things as well. And then, of course, pharmacokinetics relates a lot to this as well. Some medications have a lot more to do with the way that medication is eliminated based on the patient's own physiology. And age of the patient and things like that can all come into play. And then, of course, what can happen is something we need to really relay to our patients in the patient education component. We also need to understand, of course, why the med's being given. And these are all questions that anybody who's been through nursing school knows that your clinical instructors really work with you a lot on. At least mine did. It was a common question. This whole series of questions were common questions. And it's important to know why a med is being given. It's not always being given for the topmost indication in a drug guide. It may be given for an off-label use by a physician. It may be given as a prophylactic. We need to understand these types of things. So we need to review contraindications and indications. We need to know, is it being given to treat a symptom as a preventative measure, such as in a vaccine? Is it a maintenance medication that this patient needs to have regularly and in a certain time frame, such as some antidepressants or blood pressure medications? Is it a curative medication that is being not given to treat the symptom, but to treat the underlying cause of symptoms? And so these are all things that are important to keep in mind when we wonder why this med's being given. Next up, we want to think about what are the interactions for this medication. And this includes a lot of things. So I'm just going to run down the list, but you should be reviewing these things in your mind, thinking about it, whether it's an IV fluid conflict, an interaction with other medication, an interaction with the patient's dietary regimen, and also including with that any herbal over-the-counter medications or traditional medicines that this patient might be taking. The patient's own history can cause an interaction, whether it's their medical history, their physiological history, their cultural history, any of these things, any aspect of the patient's whole can be affecting and interacting with this medication, and we should be aware of that. Cultural interactions are very important to understand, because some medications, based upon how they are derived, or if they are blood products or side products from blood products, may not be allowed due to the patient's cultural or religious beliefs, and these need to be addressed and understood. Finally, we need to know what kind of interactions there are and communicate those to our patients as well. Now, with routes of administration, we need to think about some things. We need to know which routes are available. Different medications are available in different forms and available for different routes of administration. Some routes of administration are absolutely contraindicated. So you may have a medication that is available to be given via IV, but should not be given under any circumstances via any other injectable route. We need to know that so that you don't mistakenly administer this medication IM or sub-Q or in some other manner. We need to understand the planned onset of action. Different routes of administration will affect how long it takes for the medication to start taking effect. And of course, routes of administration have their own side effects. Some medications are harsh on the venous system, and we need to be aware of that so that we can keep an eye on their IV sites and make sure that continuous administration of a medication is not causing irritation and causing us to need to switch out and start new IV sites. We need to understand the patient's history. They may have a history of side effects or poor reactions to certain routes of administration. You know, if a patient, and like a pediatric patient, but I have no adult patients who have this problem too, can't take a pill or can't swallow a pill, we need to come up with a liquid form of the medication, find out if it can be crushed and put in things like applesauce. These are all things that we should be aware of with association with the patient's history and routes of administration. And finally, just general interactions that might be caused by the routes of administration and concurrently with other meds. Sometimes you can't administer a medication through an IV line where a similar or another medication has been administered recently because it can cause some things to precipitate out into solution. They may not be an IV fluid incompatibility, but there may be a medication incompatibility there. And so these are all things that we need to understand with regards to routes of administration. And then finally, we all come back to patient education. Whether you're administering the medicine or they're taking it themselves, we need to make sure our patients are informed masters of their own care. They need to understand why they're taking the medication, what it's for, and what to look for in way of side effects, how long they should wait for the symptoms to be resolved if we're treating a symptom. These are all things we should have the patients be knowledgeable about so they can help educate us. So educate your patients and then make sure you follow up. So we always use things like the ADPIE method or ADP, however you want to do it, ADPIE. Assess patient knowledge, diagnose any patient knowledge deficits, plan a new approach to give them the information they need, and then implement that planned educational approach. And then evaluate the effectiveness. You know, you can teach somebody all day long, and if they fell asleep in the middle of it and woke up at the end and you never reevaluated to see what they picked up along the way, you'll never know whether they understood not to take that medication more than once a day or more than twice a day, even if they're taking it 8 hours apart. That might indicate to some they can take it 3 times a day. You need to make sure you follow up and have them demonstrate the knowledge back to you in some way, and then reassess and re-educate as needed. So these are important things. There are links in the show notes with some additional information for you to follow up on, and I would urge you to do this because there's a lot of good information out there on safe medication administration. And that's about it for this tip of the week. I want to remind you that, of course, there's a much longer version and more in-depth version of this tip for those of you that are members of the nursingtopstudent.com site. And there's a lot of other great resources over there for the rest of you if you're interested and are looking for some additional assistance in nursing school. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to remind everybody that you need to check back in for the show notes for everything discussed in this episode. All of the news items, tip files, and other links mentioned are all available in the show notes for this and every other episode. And you need to follow up on the information because I can provide only general information here. It's your job to follow the links and look at the resources and see how they apply to your own scope of practice. I'll do my job here and get you as much information as I can. It's your job to follow up, make sure that the information gels with what you know and what you're supposed to be doing in your area. I'd like to urge all of you to comment and get back in touch with me here at The Nursing Show. You can reach me, of course, by leaving comments over at nursingshow.com. There are comment links at the bottom or near the top of every single article. You can also reach me by email, comments@nursingshow.com. And you can also get a hold of me over at Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic, or you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic. Time to close out the show with some PodSafe music. This week, a song from Matthew Ebel, MatthewEbel.com, will get you to Matthew's site. And you can also find his stuff over at the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This is Matthew's song, Drive Away. I hope you enjoy it, and we'll follow up and let him know you heard his song here on The Nursing Show. There's also a link to purchase his songs over at iTunes. It's a great way to encourage independent artists to continue to share their music with you here through your favorite podcast. In the meantime, I'll leave you all and remind you that I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and don't forget to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Shops in the bar.